Hello, this is The Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of equine internal medicine to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to equine internal medicine that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from April 26th to May 3rd, 2026. Right, first up, a paper on a tricky clinical problem, ventricular arrhythmias.
This is Junge and colleagues from the University of Zurich in Switzerland, published in the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine. It's a case series.
They describe the use of oral sotalol in four horses with sustained ventricular arrhythmias. The goal was to see if it could convert them to a normal rhythm without adverse effects, especially when standard treatments like lidocaine are unavailable or impractical.
Well, it's a case series, Alex, so we must be cautious. The population is just four horses, there's no control group, and obviously no blinding. They're simply reporting what happened.
True. But these were clinical cases. They achieved conversion to either sinus rhythm or the pre-existing atrial fibrillation in all four horses, using a dose of 2 to 4 mg per kg BID. And crucially, no adverse effects were reported.
No adverse effects in four horses is hardly a safety trial. Still, for a condition that can be life-threatening, having a potential oral treatment option is noteworthy.
Exactly. I hear you on the evidence level, Sarah. But in the field, this is still a step forward. It gives us another tool to consider, especially for hemodynamically stable cases where long-term parenteral treatment isn't feasible. It's a pragmatic option. Next, we're diving into endocrinology with a paper that will interest anyone managing EMS horses.
This is by Darch and colleagues from Murdoch University in Australia, published in Domestic Animal Endocrinology. It's a randomized, blinded, placebo-controlled crossover study.
Ah, a solid design. They wanted to know if the SGLT2 inhibitor, or eteglaflozin, could blunt the insulin spike that often follows intra-articular corticosteroid administration. They used 8 standard breds and gave them either eteglaflozin or a placebo for 4 days before and after an intra-articular triamcinolone injection.
Yes. The crossover design is excellent here. An N of 8 is small, but for this type of intensive study, it's quite powerful, as each horse serves as its own control. Blinding and placebo control are noted. This is how it should be done.
And the results were pretty clear. The maximum insulin concentration after the steroid injection was around 40 microIU per mil with the placebo, but only 17 with eteglaflozin. The statistics showed a 99% probability that the eteglaflozin response was lower.
The data seem robust. The primary outcome, insulin concentration, was measured directly. The conclusion that eteglaflozin attenuated the insulin rise seems well supported by their findings.
So what does this mean for us? It suggests that for an EMS horse that absolutely needs intra-articular steroids, pre-treating with eteglaflozin at 0.05 mg per kg could be a key strategy to reduce the risk of laminitis. It's a very practical application.
Let's move on to a paper about bisphosphonates in young horses, which is always a hot topic.
This is from Paris and colleagues at Texas A&M University in the USA, published in the Journal of Animal Science. It's a randomized and blinded study looking at cladronate disodium in exercising yearling quarter horses.
The population was 32 yearlings, split into 4 groups, a control, and then groups receiving 1, 2, or 4 doses of cladronate over 168 days. The investigators were blinded. A decent N and a sound study design.
Their goal was to see what effect cladronate had on systemic biomarkers of bone turnover. They hypothesized that resorption markers would decrease, but formation markers wouldn't change.
And they found not much. There was a temporary decrease in one resorption marker, TRAP5B, in the groups getting multiple doses. But another resorption marker, CTX1, actually increased over time in all groups, as did a formation marker, BAP.
So the drug had a minimal systemic effect on bone turnover in these young, exercising horses at this dose. The authors suggest the standard adult dose might just not be enough to cause major systemic changes in yearlings.
I think the spin here is a bit heavy, Alex. The conclusion is that it reduces a serum biomarker of osteoclast number and activity, but it only affected one of two resorption markers measured, and the effect was transient. It didn't affect the other markers as hypothesized.
I see your point. But from a clinical standpoint, this is still important. For anyone worried about the extra label use of this drug in sales prep, this study suggests that at the standard dose, it might not be causing the profound systemic shutdown of bone remodeling that people fear. But they rightly call for more research on local effects in weight-bearing bones.
All right, next is a very practical paper for anyone dealing with neonates.
This is Moore and colleagues from Ulster University in the UK in the Equine Veterinary Journal. It's a validation study for a stall-side I-G test.
A retrospective cohort design. They evaluated the analytical and clinical performance of a lateral flow test and reader called Sidekick. The aim was to see if it could provide reliable, quantitative IgG results at the point of care.
They tested it against the gold standards, RID, and an immunoturbidimetric assay. The analytical part looked good. Serial dilutions showed high repeatability, with recovery between 96 and 109% in the critical range of 4 to 8 grams per liter.
But the clinical validation used samples from only 10 foals. That's a very small cohort. While the analytical performance seems solid, the real-world performance is based on a tiny sample size, not reported if the operators were blinded to the reference results.
I hear you, but the agreement with the reference methods was reported as strong, as was the agreement between whole blood and plasma samples. The so what here is huge, Sarah. Having a reliable quantitative stall-side test means you can make a decision about plasma transfusion immediately. No more waiting a day for lab results while a foal with FPT is at risk of sepsis.
Well, if the validation holds up in larger studies, I agree. Faster decisions would absolutely improve foal care. The convenience is undeniable.
Here's a fascinating one. A case report that connects equine medicine to a rare human genetic syndrome.
This is Martin, colleagues from the University of Tennessee College of Veterinary Medicine in the USA. It's a case report in, case reports in veterinary medicine.
It describes a 12-year-old pony mare presented for dental disease and nasal discharge. But on exam, she had multiple hard bony enlargements all over her skull, mandible, and cervical vertebrae.
A case report is an N of one, so it's purely descriptive. But the findings are quite striking. CDAS T-scans confirmed disseminated proliferative bone lesions, which biopsy confirmed as osteomas. The pony also had intestinal polyps and skin cysts.
Exactly. And this constellation of findings, multiple osteomas, intestinal polyps, and epidermoid cysts, mirrors a hereditary human disease called Gardner syndrome, which is a variant of familial adenomatous polyposis.
And the connection is more than just clinical signs. They performed whole genome sequencing on the pony.
Yes, and they found a likely pathogenic single base pair insertion in the APC gene. This is the same gene associated with the syndrome in people. It's a frameshift mutation, which is highly suggestive of being the cause.
It's a compelling piece of detective work. While we can't definitively prove causation from one case, the genetic evidence is strong. A true one medicine report.
Clinically, it suggests that for horses presenting with multiple osteomas, especially with other strange signs like skin cysts, we might consider a Gardner-like syndrome as a differential. Very interesting.
Let's talk about nutrition. The next paper looks at iron absorption.
From Gluck Flynn and colleagues at North Carolina State University, this is in the Journal of Equine Veterinary Science. They wanted to see if an iron absorption test, or IAT, could be a useful tool for assessing iron status in horses.
This was an experimental study with 12 geldings. The design is a bit complex. They performed a baseline IAT, then put 8 horses on a daily iron supplement for 28 days, leaving 4 as controls, and then repeated the IAT.
The test itself involved giving a large oral dose of ferrous sulfate, 25 mg per kg, and then measuring serum iron, TIBC, ferritin, and hepcidin over the next 24 hours.
An N of 12 is okay, but splitting it into an 8-4 treatment control group creates a significant imbalance. The authors do note significant time effects on the blood parameters after the iron dose, which shows the test does provoke a measurable response.
The key finding for me was that the hepcidin response during the second IAT was significantly higher in the iron supplemented group. This makes sense biologically. Hepcidin is the main regulator of iron absorption, and it increases when iron stores are high to block further absorption.
Well, it suggests the test is capable of detecting a physiological response to iron loading. But the conclusion that supplementation times increases absorption post-IAT seems counterintuitive. I think the authors meant the test can reveal changes in iron regulation due to supplementation. The wording is a little confusing.
Perhaps, but the clinical takeaway is that a simplified IAT could be a practical way to investigate a horse's iron status and regulation, which could be useful in complex cases of anemia or poor performance where we suspect iron issues. Next up, a paper relevant to our foal specialists, looking at alternatives for treating flexural limb deformities.
This comes from Cardino and colleagues at the University of Veterinary Medicine, Hanover, in Germany. It's an in vitro study published in Scientific Reports.
They used a collagen gel contraction assay to assess potential alternatives to oxytetracycline. The idea is that oxytetracycline's effect isn't antimicrobial, but rather related to inhibiting MMPs, or collagen cross-linking, which causes tendon relaxation.
Ah, but this is an in vitro study. We are looking at equine myofibroblasts in a dish. This is a very artificial system. They tested oxytetracycline against several MMP inhibitors and a substance called BAPN, which inhibits collagen cross-linking.
And the results were interesting. Two substances, an MMP inhibitor called encyclonide and BAPN, both induced a significant inhibition of collagen gel contraction. And their effect was even more potent than oxytetracycline's in this model.
In this model, I'm just not buying it yet, Alex. An effect on tractional structuring of collagen in a gel is a long way from a safe and effective clinical treatment in a live foal. The conclusion that these are promising candidates is standard for this type of work, but it's a huge leap to the clinic.
I hear you on the stats and the model limitations, Sarah, but this is a critical first step. We use an antibiotic, oxytetracycline, for a non-antibiotic purpose, which is poor antimicrobial stewardship. Finding an effective non-antibiotic alternative would be a massive win. This study provides two potential leads for future in vivo research. It's a starting point.
And for our final paper, a public health note on a familiar foe.
This is Strelow and colleagues, publishing a Notes from the Field report in the MMWR. It's about an increase in Eastern equine encephalitis virus activity in Vermont during 2023-2024.
Right, so this isn't a research study with a PICOS structure. It's a surveillance report. There's no hypothesis being tested. It's an epidemiological update.
Correct. They're simply describing the EEEV activity based on human and equine cases and mosquito surveillance data. This virus is a major concern, causing severe neuroinvasive disease with high fatality rates in both horses and people.
The data are what they are, a report of detected cases. During 2023-2024, Vermont saw increased EEEV activity in mammals and mosquitoes, which prompted targeted public health outreach.
For clinicians, this is a direct and important message. It's a reminder that EEE is an ongoing threat, and activity levels can change from year to year and by location. It reinforces the critical importance of vaccination for horses, which is our best protective tool.
And it serves as a warning. An increase in animal cases or positive mosquito pools should raise the index of suspicion for any horse presenting with neurological signs in that area.
Absolutely. It's a reminder to stay vigilant and keep those vaccine boosters up to date.
That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster, to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.